Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we begin with a very European flourish this hour. The notes of composer Richard Wagner on a chase through Europe for much of the program. Europe with such a giant stamp on the history of the just past millennium, struggling today to maintain influence and prosperity into this one. There's a pro-Europe result from the latest polling out of Ukraine. CNN polls show that a large majority of the people of Ukraine want to remain independent of Russia and be a part of Europe, 67%. Of course, that is down from 90% from when Ukraine originally broke with the Soviet Union back in 1991. We will hear from a pair of journalists trying to tell the story of Ukraine when they are caught in the middle of its history. We'll also decode a poignant warning about our future from a largely forgotten European writer of the last century. And we finish this hour with one man's very personal journey across Europe and the world, retracing his uncle and grandfather's journey to Auschwitz, where they died in the Holocaust in 1942. But we begin with Europe's attempt to maintain the privacy of personal data in a moment when tech enterprises in the U.S. and Asia think of that data increasingly as a money-making commodity or a wide-open domain for surveillance. Joining us now, Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center and professor of law at George Washington University Law School. Jeffrey, welcome back.
Great to be here.
So this seems like a pretty huge event in Europe. The High Court in Luxembourg rules that Google has to allow European users to take down files and texts and images that they may have posted. Plus, Europe is on a road to enshrine officially a right to be forgotten.
This is a huge deal, not only in Europe, but around the world. And it represents potentially the biggest clash between privacy rights and free speech rights of the modern era. Since 2012, Europe has been debating whether to adopt a broad right to be forgotten that would allow individuals to demand the deletion of truthful but embarrassing information about themselves merely because they don't like it. This case involved a Spanish man who wanted to delete an auction notice of his house, which was repossessed after he had to recover Social Security debts. And he sued a Spanish newspaper. The Spanish court said, no, that newspaper doesn't have to delete it. But then in this sweeping ruling, the Luxembourg court said that Google and Yahoo have to remove links to the story. What's so striking about this is how amorphous the standards are. Basically, it's now up to European privacy commissioners to decide whether information is in the public interest or not, when it's relevant, when it's been up too long. And because the tech companies can't know in advance whether or not a particular request is going to be granted, they'll have an incentive to remove stuff anytime anyone requests it. So if someone writes a blog post after our talk today saying that I've given a boring account of the case, I could demand that that blog post be removed if I were in Europe. And if Google and Yahoo guessed wrong, they'd be liable for a lot of money. So I'm a privacy guy to my bones, but this is a case where privacy and free speech are in conflict, and generally the American view of free speech is that this European sweeping view of privacy is a huge threat to free expression.
Sort of ironic that Europe, which probably has as much history as anyone they would love to forget, have this intuitive sense that we can erase the postings that have been on for years online and have a certain immortality to them. How is this enforceable on any level?
It's a great question, and it is deeply rooted in European history. This comes from a French right called the droit à l'oubli, or the right of oblivion, which is very French, of course. It seems to come right out of Sartre. But the French and the Germans have long said that if you have criminal history, for example, you can remove it after a certain amount of time because people should be able to have a second chance and not always be dogged by their past. So when the right was defined that narrowly, you could enforce it because you knew what the statute of limitations was, after which you couldn't refer to someone's criminal history. But this right, which where the standards are so broad, any time that I claim the data about me violates my privacy or dignity, I can potentially demand its removal. Would literally tie up the internet in knots. So it's the difficulties of enforcement that's one of the tech company's strongest arguments against this. And it's just litigation on steroids. This will just open up a huge opportunity for aggrieved people who think that truthful but embarrassing information about them should be removed from Google to come down. And again, Google is saying this is going to transform us from a neutral search engine into a censor in chief, into an arbiter of what information is relevant or damages someone's dignity and whatnot. In the US, Google is immune from that judgment because of our Communications Decency Act, which doesn't make it liable for the content it posts. In Europe, the situation is very different, and it's just going to transform the way Google and Yahoo and others operate in Europe if this decision is sustained and extended.
Well, the legal precedents are a little sketchy here, and internationally you've described a very chaotic situation or a potential conflict between Europe and the rest of the world. But how does the law view speech that I post? I put up a picture. I can erase it from my own website. I can erase it from my own Facebook page. But how is that speech different legally from somebody else's post of my picture? Is that their speech or is that my speech? Does the law have any clarity there?
Great question. There are three categories, and they're treated differently in the U.S. and America. If I post something on Facebook, a silly picture of myself, I can take it down, no problem. Facebook's own terms of service allow me to do that. But let's say I post an embarrassing picture and it goes viral. It's widely shared. In the U.S., that would be considered other people's speech and would be protected. In Argentina, which applied an earlier version of this right to be forgotten, a pop star demanded the removal of racy pictures of herself that had gone viral, and an Argentinian judge actually ordered Yahoo to remove the pictures on the threat of a fine of a huge amount of money every day. So basically, she erased herself from history. She removed herself from the internet. If she'd been running for parliament, she could try to selectively rewrite the past. But then there's a third category of speech, and that's the stuff that was at issue in the case today. And that's just truthful but embarrassing stuff that other people write about as journalism, just straight on journalism. In the U.S., dating back to the days of Louis Brandeis, truthful but embarrassing information cannot be removed, you know, unless it's illegal or libelous or something like that. But in Europe, dignitary rights are more broadly protected, and there's a privacy directive which says that you can object to this kind of speech.
Sounds very 19th century. A decision out of Europe. Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center and professor at George Washington University Law School. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. Pleasure.
We also want to hear from you. Should you be able to erase your history on the internet? Do you think we should have the right to be forgotten online? Angie says this, yes. It's one thing to have them note how many times we went to a site, but it's another to have them tell every Tom, Dick, and Harry to go bug this person to death with ads, pop-ups, etc. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us what internet history you'd like to erase, if anything. But I guess that would be like posting it again to our radio audience. Right, okay. Then just take our poll by visiting us at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Today, the German foreign minister is in Kiev to try and push a diplomatic solution to the crisis in Ukraine as the world watches. Frank-Walter Steinmeier urged all Ukrainians to vote in the presidential elections later this month and called for dialogue with the pro-Russian people of eastern Ukraine who voted in a referendum over the weekend to secede. The prospect of Ukrainians having to choose between Germany and Russia in 2014, two countries that caused so much slaughter and misery for Ukraine in the last century, is just one of the historical complications facing journalists covering this crisis. For Ukrainian journalists, though, in the middle of it all, the challenge is even greater. And we got a sense of that when a group of them visited New York City and spoke to us last week. Ruslan Denyachenko and Yevhen Fedchenko are with the Kiev Molya School of Journalism, where Yevhen says his classrooms have been transformed by the events of this year.
It's really very difficult to teach now because usually when I was explaining how to cover war and conflicts, I was using example from other countries, and now that's kind of situation within. The main thing I try to deliver to students is that you really need to look into what really happens through this fog of war, because you have a lot of disinformation, you have a lot of propaganda, including a lot of Russian propaganda, which is orchestrated by the government, is very powerful, has a lot of media outlets to deliver these messages, including the social media. Yeah. So now we have, you know, a lot of information, meaning that you really need to look through much more to find the truth among that.
Yeah,
and Ruslan?
I think that, unfortunately, Ukraine was not prepared for this information war.
Who is?
I think Russian media were very
really?
Well. Yeah, they were very well prepared. And at the beginning of the conflict, we saw so many, like a flood of propaganda from Russian media. And the Ukrainian media were not prepared to give information and to fight with them, to demonstrate something different. The only one way we can protect our citizens from Russian propaganda is to show them the real things. Ukrainian journalists can go to Crimea and they will follow what are the changes of lives of regular citizens over there. Are they happy with the new Russian government or not? Is their lives changing for better or for worse?
And what is the answer, at least in the early going? Is life better? Is the promise of Russia more than it's worth?
So far, not. Because most of the tourists in Crimea, they were Ukrainian citizens. And now Crimea does not have tourists from Ukraine. So they relied on resources from Ukraine, like water, like electricity, like everything. And now they have to pay higher prices for that. And not a lot of people are happy. They expected that Russia will give them money for free and they will be happy. But now they understand that it's not so easy.
As journalists, what do you make of the argument that some in the West have made that NATO and Europe really misread the situation on the border with Russia, in that Vladimir Putin was just not going to allow NATO to expand beyond Poland, that that he wanted a solid sort of end to this embrace of the West, and that the U.S. and Germany and Europe assumed that Putin would just sort of back down. Are they right?
I guess now it's clear to everybody what the strategy of Putin is. It's really, as you mentioned, to stop NATO and even European Union moving eastwards. And he could partly achieve that through different means, including the military, as we see in Crimea. And I guess his idea is to create as many conflicts around border of Russia. One of the reasons why they're doing that is, again, to demonstrate that Ukraine is unstable. There is no government which controls the territory. There is no military power in Ukraine that can guarantee the sovereignty. And Putin was never hiding that he does not recognize Ukraine as a sovereign state. So what he's restoring is basically the Soviet Union, but in much worse form. And I'm not sure that Western countries were able to grasp the size of these changes. They are titanic.
They were not prepared. And the only one question for me, who is next? Is it Baltic states where the huge Russian population, or who else?
Are there people that you cannot speak with anymore, can't talk to in the same way?
My wife, for example, she has relatives in Moscow. Now they cannot talk because they are brainwashed by Russian television, and they call and they say, "Hey, what's going on over there? What are you doing? Your fascist government is doing this and this and that." And it's just nonsense because nothing even close. It's not even same zip code. So for my wife, it's hard to talk with her Russian relatives. But people in Ukraine, they understand what's going on. It's hard time for the country, for the government, and for all of us. And I would say that people became more friendly, more helpful to each other. I would say we are at the beginning of the path to something very good.
Can your message win the day, given what you're up against with the Russian media, which you say was way more prepared than the Ukrainian media? Can you win this?
Yeah, absolutely, because the truth has always a chance to win, because finally people realize that white is white and you cannot say it's the opposite. Like Russian media portraying those terrorists in the east of Ukraine as, you know, popular uprising, which is completely untrue and unsupported by facts.
Yevhen and Ruslan, thank you so much and good luck.
Thank you for having us.
Ruslan Dinyachenko and Yevhen Fedchenko are Ukrainian journalists with the Kiev Molya School of Journalism in Ukraine. We caught up with them while they were on a trip to the United States. Coming up, thinking positively about American ingenuity.
We face a lot of challenges. There's no question. Fresh water supply being an obvious one. Overuse of pesticides, another one. climate change, clearly. But look, there are plenty of reasons to be optimistic.
Writer and journalist Robert Bryce will share his optimism with us later, but we want to know from you what things you do each day that save energy and what things waste it.
I save energy by not running my air conditioner until it gets to about 90 degrees.
I ride my bike to work to save money on gas.
We have rain barrels at our downspouts to save all that runoff for our garden. But I have to admit that I leave the shower on when I'm washing my hair.
And I leave my computer on at night when I'm not using it.
I leave the TV on to keep my dog company during the day.
TV is a dog's best friend, I always say. Call us at 877-8MYTAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Talk about history that cannot be erased. He died in 2009, but the king of pop, Michael Jackson, releases a new album today, somewhat spookily called Escape. That's the single Love Never Felt So Good. Here to discuss the album is John Schaefer, host of WNYC's Soundcheck and New Sounds. Welcome back, as always, John.
Hi, John.
So what are the materials that make up this album? Because there's the obvious question of the absence of the king himself.
Yeah, who is remarkably present on this record. He left behind some pretty, some vocal tracks that were in pretty good shape. So, I mean, they're going back to like the 1980s. He sounds great. I mean, the voice sounds great on this record. It's a bit of a Frankenstein's monster, contemporary producers like Timbaland taking these vocal tracks and creating kind of new musical context for them.
And what have you got here that sort of shows how this Frankenstein monster was assembled?
Yeah, well, there's an interesting tune called A Place With No Name, which fans of the old America song, The Horse With No Name, will get kind of a whiff of that song here. Michael Jackson's original demo had those America classic rock chords. And what they've done, the Norwegian production team known as Stargate, has kind of stripped that away and put a whole new sound under Michael Jackson's voice.
As I drove across on the highway, my Jeep began to rock. I didn't know what to do, so I stopped and got out and looked down. I noticed I got a flat tire. So I walked out, parked the car like sideways.
Jeez, that is an amazing cover.
Well, not really a cover, kind of a riff on the old song by the band America. And I chose this one because it shows what works and doesn't work about this new Michael Jackson record. What works is it's really interesting. I mean, it's inventive, the way that they've treated these Michael Jackson tracks and tried to contemporize, in the word of executive producer L.A. Reid, contemporize Michael Jackson's voice. What maybe doesn't work is Michael Jackson didn't get to be the king of pop by accident. He knew a good song when he wrote one, and he knew a near miss when he wrote one. And I think what we've got here is a bunch of songs that, for anybody else might be okay. For Michael Jackson, they're just kind of like maybe the producers did their job too well, and maybe some of this music is indistinguishable from other pop music that we're hearing right now.
What about the nostalgia play here? There's some bass tracks, some riffs that are clearly reminiscent of old Michael Jackson material.
Yeah, and some of that seems like it is not intentional. It seems like that's some of the current crop of producers kind of falling into old habits. Some of it might be intended, but I think the real brief here was to make these Michael Jackson songs sound like they could have been written and produced in 2014. And, maybe they did that. Maybe they did that a little too well. The album Escape is, probably covers maybe 10 or more years of these little odds and ends of Michael Jackson.
Blue Gangsta.
This one's not bad. I mean, it's sort of the Michael Jackson of Beat It, that kind of edgier voice of his. Works, I think, about as well as anything on the record.
You think this will do well?
I think it's going to be huge, right? For Michael Jackson completists, it's a must-have.
John Schaefer, host of WNYC Soundcheck and New Sounds. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
There's an energy boom out west, and high oil prices and new drilling technology have opened areas that missed the oil booms of the 20th century. Eastern New Mexico is suddenly home to some of the most productive oil fields of the Permian Basin, which spans across West Texas into New Mexico. There were over 900 applications for oil digging sites last year. Once sleepy towns like Carlsbad and Hobbs have more people, more crime, and pricey housing. Eastern New Mexico is also one of the most water-stressed places in the U.S., and demands from this oil boom are raising the possibility that an oil economy may not be sustainable here. We turn now to Monica Ortiz Uribe. She's a senior field correspondent for Fronteras. Monica, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
So what are some of the bottlenecks the people in Carlsbad are seeing?
Well, it's incredible. Housing is the number one issue. With all the new companies moving in, it's also meant new workers moving in. And those new workers create new demands on the city, including at the schools, at the police department. And you talk to people there, and they can't find housing.
A boom is definitely a problem for Superintendent Gary Perkowski in Carlsbad. Listen.
All of a sudden, it's going up, and going up very quickly and very drastically. Last year, we lost 10 teachers that came to Carlsbad, signed contracts, and could not find housing. We had one guy that was trying to live with his family in a motel at $100-something a night, and that didn't last long.
So demand for teachers is complicated by the fact that there's no place for them to live, and that is duplicated in other professions.
Right, right. And so the superintendent was one of the more fascinating interviews I had. He was saying that the voters passed a $60 million bond issue, almost 70% in favor, to build four new schools because of this very problem. You heard him talk about one teacher that was living in a motel. The motel rates in Carlsbad are as high as you would pay in New York City just because there's not enough of them. And people are choosing to live there. And the apartments, they're being filled up before they're even built.
Here's Mayor of Carlsbad, Dale Janway.
Well, this is one of the hot spots in the country right now, and there are a lot of challenges. Anytime you have growth like we have, you have more emergency calls, more fire calls, more police problems.
And more opportunities for jobs, apparently. Mayor Janway is moonlighting in the oil industry, right?
He is. Yeah, he had just come from the oil fields when we met at a restaurant for lunch. He works as a safety consultant. And so there are more jobs than there are people to fill them. And we're talking about not just Carlsbad, but neighboring towns like Artesia and Hobbs. You drive down the streets and you'll see help wanted signs on almost every restaurant.
What is the sense that water pressures in this region could put a real cap on this boom?
Well, the thing that makes New Mexico unique, New Mexico and Texas, is the water situation out there. You look at the drought monitor map in past year, and it looks like New Mexico has a bullseye on it, especially on the southeast corner. It looks like a big red blotch. The aquifers there are only potable in a few spots, and those are being depleted faster than they're being replenished. The Pecos River, which is also the main source of surface water, last year it went dry for dozens of miles, and that's unusual. The farmers are deciding to sell their water rights to the oil and gas companies because it's much more profitable than actually growing crops. So these wells take millions of gallons of water to produce. And so it's happening so fast, I don't think people quite realize just if the water situation can sustain the growth, not only of the oil wells, but of the growth in the cities as well.
Reporting from the oil boom towns in eastern New Mexico, Monica Ortiz Uribe is a senior field correspondent for Fronteras. Thanks so much, Monica.
Pleasure to be here.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Behind the noisy debate over human-caused climate change, a debate that more politicians are having these days than scientists, the vast majority of scientists believe this is a settled question. There is another discussion, though. Do we use our ingenuity to adapt to the consequences of global warming or restrain global demand to try and reverse those consequences? Is one more practical than the other? Well, Manhattan Institute senior fellow Robert Bryce is an optimist, solidly in the adaptation camp. His book is called Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper: How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophists Wrong. Bryce is anxious to generate some controversy and raise the noise level in what he calls the adapt or die debate.
We face a lot of challenges. There's no question. Fresh water supply being an obvious one. Overuse of pesticides, another one. Climate change, clearly. But look, there are plenty of reasons to be optimistic. And when we look at the trends in innovation towards smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper, they're incredibly positive trends that I think will continue.
And two of those trends do not include solar panels and wind generators, in your view.
Well, let's look at solar. I have solar panels on the roof of my house. I'm bullish on solar. Look at the cost and declining cost of solar. It was $20 a watt in the 1980s. Today, it's less than a dollar a watt. It's very appropriate in many locations around the world, rural applications in particular. But look at the data. Look at the numbers. The reality is that solar and wind energy, for whatever their merits, they can't even meet growth in demand in global energy, much less displace significant quantities of hydrocarbons. The problem is basic physics and simple math. There's no conspiracy here against these sources. It's just that they take too much land, and we don't have a lot of spare land to put up massive arrays of wind turbines or to plant whole continents effectively in biofuels.
Of course, with nuclear, you got a land problem if something goes wrong, like in Fukushima. They got a few acres out of commission up there.
Of course. And again, I'm not diminishing that, and the costs at Fukushima are enormous. But why should we pursue nuclear? Why are we pursuing nuclear even after Fukushima? It's because of the incredibly high power density, where we're talking millions of watts per square meter inside the core of the reactor. Even if you look at plants like San Onofre in California, you're talking 2,000 watts per square meter of power density versus wind at 1 watt per square meter and biofuels at a fraction of a watt per square meter.
If we were only looking at energy demand, environmentalists say we can have our cake and eat it too if coal is developed in an unrestricted, maximalist kind of strategy. There is enough coal there to fuel virtually anything that we want to do, but at a huge environmental price. In this book, you really take directly on some of the tensions of developing coal, the temptation of developing coal, and some of the technological limitations. Where does coal come out in your debate?
If we just look at the numbers, John, and you look at the trends in coal consumption, since 1973, it's the fastest growing form of energy globally. Look at the last 10 years. Global coal consumption has equaled the growth in oil, natural gas, nuclear, and hydro combined. So when I looked at coal, I thought, man, this is difficult because it both confirms and beggars my thesis. It's not smaller. It's not faster. It's not lighter.
It's not denser.
It's not denser. But what we see is coal being used to generate electricity, and nothing is smaller, faster, or lighter than electrons. And therein is the issue that for countries that want to develop, they're going to use coal because they have to have electricity. The essentiality of electricity to modernity is incontrovertible. So the countries that are now developing, whether it's Vietnam, China, India, you name it, they're turning to coal first because it's the cheapest option.
But what's going to be the fix if there is unrestricted demand for coal and coal is developed all over the world? There are going to be environmental implications of that, that the faster, lighter, cheaper, denser economy is going to have to deal with fairly quickly.
There's no question. And what is clearly needed is better combustion technology that will restrict the amount of particulates and other pollutants that come out of the smokestack, because facts show that this is such a fast-growing form of energy because people are so desperate for electricity.
So a better investment than wind energy would be investing in cleaner coal, knowing that the demand is going to rise.
For the developing world, there's no question. But I think that in my view, I'm very bullish on end-to-end, natural gas to nuclear. If we're serious about climate change, if we really want to address the CO2 emissions issue, we should be pursuing natural gas and nuclear. We are in the United States. We have a huge surge in natural gas production. It's been a key reason why the U.S. has reduced its CO2 emissions more over the last few years than any other country in the world. Nuclear is problematic because of cost. It's problematic because of regulation globally. But there is a very positive trend, I think, in the nuclear space now where we're seeing venture capitalists go in there trying to develop safer, cheaper reactors. And I'm very hopeful for that.
Now, there's a lot of hopeful messages in this book. But are you concerned that people will take the simplistic view here and go, we don't need to worry about climate change. We don't need to worry about some of these problems because here's this guy who's going to innovate us to the future. And we can use a book like this to really go after the environmentalists. And I'm sure there are plenty of media outlets who would be happy to do that.
Well, and I'm certain that's probably the case. But I think that in my view, we've had too much attention, frankly, on climate models and not enough attention on fuel cell models, on engine models, on these ideas about how do we use energy more efficiently to produce the power that we need for any given application. Because that's where the gold is, I think, that as we try and bring more people out of darkness, truly darkness, into modernity, how do we do it most efficiently and therefore reduce their amount of CO2 emissions and other externalities?
What's the most controversial suggestion that you make in this book that you would love to be adopted tomorrow?
Well, I think it would be the need for cheap, abundant, reliable energy. What cheap energy allows is for an economy to develop. It's the wealthy countries that can protect the environment, by and large. I mean, you look at the poor countries anywhere in the world. Are they able to protect the environment? No, they're generally not. But cheap energy is the fundamental base for any modern society. So that if we can get cheap energy, we can get to better environmental protection because the two go hand in hand, in my view.
Although some people will listen to what you're saying and say, all right, for the 21st century then, what you're advocating is a kind of an environmental colonialism where the rich countries will have breathable air and the developed countries will not and will have to struggle along with these same technologies and thereby will be the division of the world in the 21st century.
Well, I argue that point all day long. I don't think that's true at all. In India alone, you have 1 million people, mostly women and girls, dying from indoor air pollution. Why? Because they're using low-quality fuels. Why can't they use butane, propane? Why don't they have natural gas? Why don't they have modern energy sources? Because that means better indoor air standards, air quality for them that saves lives.
Robert Price is the author of Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophists Wrong. Robert, thanks so much.
Thanks a million.
We're asking you, what are your energy-saving and energy-consuming habits?
This is Erin from Pompton Lakes, New Jersey. I keep my lights off and my air conditioning turned up to 73 to 75, so it's not running all the time. My heat I keep at 65 or 66. I also started using paper bags whenever I can or reusable bags.
This is Adriana from Dallas, Texas, and I have changed all the light bulbs in my house to be energy-efficient light bulbs. However, I also love my clothes dryer. I love to dry everything on high.
What would we do without clothes dryers? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to tell us about your clothesline. And now the power of chasing history and sometimes its utility. We end this hour with some thoughts about Europe's darkest 20th century ghost, a ghost that haunts all of the nations of the world. 75 years ago today, on May 13, 1939, the MS St. Louis set sail from Hamburg, Germany, with 937 German Jewish refugees seeking asylum aboard, first in Cuba, then the United States, then in Canada. All three countries refused to take them, and the ship eventually returned to Europe. It was not a homecoming. Two of the Jewish refugees, Alexander Goldschmidt and his son Helmut, stepped from that ship on a journey that would take them to Auschwitz, where they would die in 1942. Alexander's grandson is a writer, and he's the familiar, gentle host of the old NPR Performance Today program, Martin Goldsmith. He retraced that journey to write his new book, Alex's Wake, A Voyage of Betrayal and a Journey of Remembrance. Martin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, John. It's great to be with you.
So how did you first hear about this story in your family, that your grandfather and uncle were aboard this ship and were struggling to escape and to find asylum?
My mother and father managed to escape Germany in 1941 because they were musicians playing in an all-Jewish orchestra called the Kulturbund. They arrived in this country in 1941, about the same time that my grandfather Alex and my uncle Helmut first were in the French concentration camp Rivesaltes, before being sent to Les Mille, before being sent to Drancy, before being sent to Auschwitz. We spoke very little about that when I was growing up. It wasn't until I began doing research for my first book, The Inextinguishable Symphony, that my father handed me a small stack of letters that he had received from his father and his younger brother from those French camps, and it was then that I first heard about the St. Louis.
And you had to make a decision to create this book, to essentially step into territory that your father refused to go to help, and it's not clear if he could have done anything, get your grandfather and uncle out of the hands of the Germans.
That is correct. When my mother and father arrived in this country in 1941, they were obviously refugees. They managed to cobble together menial jobs, which brought them $26 a week in pay. They would occasionally send $25 via the Quakers to my grandfather and uncle in those camps in France. They probably really couldn't have done anything substantive to save them, but the fact remains that my father went to his grave realizing that he didn't do everything he possibly could. He was burdened with a great deal of guilt. He passed some of that guilt on to me, I realize, not wittingly, of course. So I, 3 years ago, decided that if my father couldn't save his father and brother, I would somehow try in a irrational way to try to save my grandfather and my uncle, which was one of the reasons that I began this six-week, 5,700-mile journey in their footsteps.
What was it like to wander through the Europe of the 21st century in relative wealth and privilege, but stepping on the exact same soil that your grandfather and uncle stepped on?
Well, it was simultaneously exhilarating and very saddening. Since my grandfather and uncle were murdered 10 years before I was born, I obviously had never had the opportunity to meet them. So driving into, say, the town of Montauban in France, where they had been held in an old cookie factory for a month, and finding police records of their existence there with a big letter J in red at the top of the card, J for Juif, was exciting. It was exciting to come upon evidence of their existence having been there, but simultaneously, of course, it was quite saddening. And I felt a good deal of guilt myself, traveling, as you mentioned, John, in relative comfort, driving down French roads in an air-conditioned car, staying in rather nice hotels, while my grandfather and uncle obviously had traversed that same route at the point of a gun, often in cattle cars.
You know, everyone has the experience of going into a closet of a lost loved one and smelling the clothes, touching the artifacts of someone who's no longer here. What did you see when you looked at the documents, at the ephemeral evidence of where your grandfather and uncle had been along this journey?
I somehow began to piece together little bits of their character. When I was in Oldenburg, Germany, where my grandfather established a very successful women's clothing store and where my uncle attended the Altes Gymnasium, the high school in Oldenburg, I came upon stories about my uncle, only 17 years old, standing up in an assembly in 1938, just weeks before Kristallnacht, condemning a German speaker who was spreading all of these stories about the bad effects of the Jews on German society. My uncle, 17 years old, stood up and shouted, "Das ist alles Lüge." These are all lies. Mm. Still today in Oldenburg, at that school, he is honored for that little moment of courage. I discovered a letter in the French concentration camp of Agde, hard by the Mediterranean Sea, a letter that my grandfather wrote to the district leader begging for his freedom. And he wrote in impeccable French, though he was born in Germany. I discovered a little bit about his determination. So at the end of this six-week journey, I felt that I knew these phantoms that I had been chasing just a little bit better.
Your grandfather, Alex, died in one of the gas chambers in Birkenau. He was 63. And At Barracks 20 in Auschwitz, where your Uncle Helmut died, probably of a lethal injection or typhus in a clinic, you left a photograph. What does that mean to you, and what does it mean to the rest of us before we go?
Yes, my Uncle Helmut was tattooed with the number 59305 and was died either of typhus or, as you say, lethal injection. At age 21, I did leave his photograph there in Barracks 20, as I left a photograph of my grandfather in the ruined crematoria in Birkenau. It was an attempt to lay flowers on their grave, and it was something that I'm very, very pleased that I was able to do. It was an act of remembrance, which is something that I think all of us need to do to ensure that crimes of that sort are never possible again.
But not a futile remembrance, a grasping at meaning.
I don't think so.
No.
Yes, yes, it was a meaning that they are not forgotten. And then as a postscript to this six-week journey, I returned a year later to a ceremony where a plaque was affixed to the wall of my grandfather's former house, which speaks in German of what had happened to the family, how they were murdered in Auschwitz, and my grandmother and aunt murdered at the ghetto in Riga. And the plaque concludes with two lines from a poem by Emily Dickinson. Remembrance has a rear and front. 'Tis something like a house.
Not so irrational an impulse. Martin Goldsmith, author of Alex's Wake, A Journey of Betrayal and A Journey of Remembrance. Thanks so much, Martin.
Thank you, John.
We had a remembrance of Viennese intellectual Stefan Zweig earlier this hour. He once wrote, "No guilt is forgotten, so long as the conscience still knows of it." We want to hear from you. What does your conscience tell you? Should we be able to erase history on the internet or anywhere? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.